A podcast of the cinema
with me, Dave White,
and me, Alonso Duralde.
We are film critics for The Wrap. You're the film critic. You're the film editor. You're the film reviews editor. I always, the film reviews editor. And this is the show. And what a show is going to be today.
Oh, boy, howdy.
Because we have guests. Not one, not two, but three.
Yes, it is our annual year in review wrap up with the usual gang of idiots, as they used to say at Mad Magazine. please welcome our guests, Robert Abley from the LA Times and The Wrap, Peter DeBruch from Variety, and Manola Dargis from the New York Times. Welcome.
Now, you just said those names very quickly.
Did I?
Robert Abley.
Robert Abley. Peter DeBruch.
And Manola Dargis.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
All the different places that they write for.
Yes.
All represented here.
All right. So clearly.
Our annual visit. Or maybe you guys come in more often. It's sort of a tradition.
Yes, we're seeing you behind your back.
During the rest of the year, y'all are blacklisted.
But we love this. This is sort of our annual, best of the year.
Absolutely.
Hubbub chit chat. Now,
if
it didn't come.
This isn't being recorded, is it?
It didn't come out till December 20th, but I think we can all agree that this was the whole year was about cats.
Oh, absolutely.
No question.
For me. Yeah.
It's just waiting in anticipation, especially after the trailer dropped.
Ooh, yeah.
I went in as a cat's virgin because I refused to watch the trailer because I knew that I needed to really kind of
be caught by surprise.
Have the full cats.
I always think of you as a cat's lady, Manola.
I am a cat's lady. We only have three currently. I wanted to go in with, completely and be surprised. And oh my gosh.
Surprise was definitely the main feeling people had who weren't familiar with the show to begin with.
Now, does the fact that so many people had such a strong response to this film, I mean, obviously it says a lot about the nuttiness of the movie, but does it speak to the larger sense of predictability and safety about mainstream movies that we walk into most movies knowing exactly what we're going to get? And this was sort of the rare occasion of like, oh, I did not see that coming.
Well, I mean, don't we know what we're going to get? If you have seen the musical, it's going to be some version of that, that phrase that they like to use here in the industry, execution dependent, and every choice on the execution of this is wrong.
Well, yeah, that helps.
I have to say that, having seen it, the two times I'd seen it on stage, once was as a teenager in London in its original theater, where it was an environmental experience and very spectacle oriented, and you can actually kind of get into it. And then I saw it in a touring production in Dallas, where when you're watching it in an arena, and it's all it's all on a small stage. You're seeing from the back. You're like, oh my god, this show is way too bizarre. What was I thinking? This is really a bad show. knowing that it could be any of these things, possibly when you go see the movie, it could be, you're kind of thinking it's an unpredictable experience, possibly, and it ended up being in the bad way.
I don't know. I feel like so much of franchise cinema is reliant upon the idea that we know what we're getting when we go in. Mm-hmm. That we walk into an Avengers movie, we walk into a 50 Shades movie, whatever. It's the parameters are there. It's nothing is going to blow us to the back of the room going, whoa, what? So I don't know. I think that's my theory about part of why the Cats experience has sort of caught on so quickly.
Well, but also because it's not just even franchises, but I think because everything is, so checked and rechecked, and they have these test screenings and so forth. And so it was really the one thing that I had heard before going in was that Tom Hooper, the director, the absolutely incorrect director for this material, had just finished it before the premiere.
Yes,
thing. And I thought, whoa. This could be surprising. And so that seemed very unusual, but I think that was a really kind of the fact that he had won Oscars, that he had this kind of credibility, that by certain kind of mainstream Hollywood standards. You know, he's a respectable director. I mean, I think he's a snore, but it's just...
And he'd already ruined one musical, but somehow, but it was a hit, so...
Boom. Well, in retrospect, like, why not just give the guy 6 more months and $80 million more dollars to get it right, right? Because it was on such a, you know, a train to success.
I mean, a movie that I kind of think of that's, you know, I grant from the get-go that I'm one of its few partisans, which is Peter Bogdanovich's At Long Last Love. But he talks about how, you know, Broadway shows open out of town for a reason. Like musicals, you have to sort of like show them to people and get a feel for what works and what the pacing is and that kind of thing. And like he has a cut of that movie now that's totally different from the one that premiered at Radio City Music Hall back in 75 or whatever. And you know, because he got to sort of play around with the pacing of it and stuff. And so, yeah, when you finish Cats the morning before the premiere, you don't get that chance to sort of like take it to New Haven or whatever you do, whatever the movie equivalent of that is, to be like, is this working? Does this play? Or, you know, what's going on?
You're describing the story of Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, as you know, like, he didn't finish it the morning before the premiere. He, like, there was another cut that kind of came out a few days into the run.
The patches, yeah.
But I just kept thinking it later as I was sitting there trying to think of something to write about it, that at what point did anyone say, well, this is a good idea? You know, like, at what point do you think, well, we're going to have people dressed as cats, we're going to digitally remove their genitals, we're going to add digital fur. I was so completely perplexed by the very idea that this would be turned into a movie, like, well, and not an animated movie, because I think an animation might have worked, maybe, possibly.
It would have a better chance, I think.
For all we know, everybody who worked on it secretly thought that and couldn't say anything out loud, like the Trump administration. I mean, like, you know, it's just that you're just letting this thing happen. And
hope that you're
secretly
not
going to
get blamed for
you all
it later.
Secretly don't like it.
Well, no, but like, go back to the original Cats musical, which goes on to be the longest running, biggest grossing, you know, show of its time. And surely everyone was asking this, like, you're going to take poems, you know, and set them to music, and you're going to have, you know,
it was a huge
people in
gamble.
Cat costumes,
right?
You know, with kind of like punk rock hair, and it. I mean, it did catch on, and I mean, for me, the big miscalculation. I mean, as someone who...
Oh, there's one?
I mean, of the many, is the idea that, like, dance is such a big part of the show's definition. Mm. I mean, it's like, and the choreography is, you know, so much a part of that, and the sexual nature of the choreography, which we kind of don't say, but is, you know, when you're 13 and you see the show, it, you know, it's a highly erotic thing, and the way that they're dancing is highly erotic, and, you know, it's like the thing that I quoted in my review is the directive was nipples to the sky. It was like, and the note she gave to the men was even more vulgar, but it was about kind of leading with their now non-existent genitals. And it's like, and the idea was to have this kind of dynamic, and there's nothing.
A feline orgy? Is that what you're saying? Was supposed to be? Is that what the musical is?
I think that it just emphasizes the kind of physicality of it, and there's something kind of, you know, interesting about seeing humans interpret the body language of cats on stage, and also kind of like flirting and, you know, and cavorting with one another. But that's not the way Tom Hooper shoots a musical.
Anything.
That's not how he shoots Les Miserables. That's not how he shot this. So it's like you've taken that element out of it, and then all you're left with is this horrible music and other problems.
But, you know, the problem really with the movie is that it wasn't far out enough. I mean, I think the highlight of the movie is really the dancing Bubsy Berkeley cockroaches with, you know, that and James Condon's, I like, you know, because they're far out, you know? It's like they're pushing it.
The milk bar, those
right.
kind of
well,
things.
The tap dancing railroad cat, it's like, you know, they were saying on the Flophouse, like, tap dancing is a thing we know from the earliest cinema that plays and that people like to watch. And so for that moment that you get tap dancing, it, like, the movie kind of feels like a musical for a hot second, and then it's
right.
Well,
it's
gone. And for me, like, I think I mentioned in my review, like, the Taylor Swift number, which is the one that works the most in terms of a conventional musical number. But I mean, I remember it giving me that feeling of, oh, this could have been something Ken Russell-like if they'd really, like, gone out there. I thought, it kind of reminded me of how fun and weird and crazy those Ken Russell movies were, where you kind of thought, this is a musical, but this is also,
Tom,
like...
Tom Hooper's just the wrong person
for
it.
Yeah.
It's
exactly.
Just the wrong sensibility. It's like, I just kept thinking about who could have really done justice to this. And, you know, it was just, could John Waters have done justice to this? I mean, just, you needed someone who would just embrace the nuttiness of it.
Well, sure. I mean, you know? Baz Luhrmann, probably.
Yeah, well.
I remember when I was a little kid seeing that sort of long extended first trailer for Tommy as I was watching some children's film, you know, but they were showing the trailers for the grown-up movies. And I remember watching that trailer and becoming absolutely obsessed with the trailer. I was not allowed to go see the film yet. And so the trailer for this musical was frightening to me. And there was such bizarre imagery in the trailer that I concocted an entire film in my head before I ever had a chance to see the movie, like 3 years down the road. And I had already, like, I consumed the album and I consumed that trailer as often as I could see it in a movie theater, like they were going to re-release the movie a year later, because they would do that sometimes back then. And thinking to myself while watching Cats, thinking, there should be something really unsettling here that freaks me out. And as funny and weird and goofy as this is, it's not freaking me out.
No.
It's almost enough, but not, because this direction is too
tame.
Safe.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
And so I yearn for the days of that moment in childhood where knowing that something was a musical and also making it feel like it's some kind of horror movie too, and giving me that like weird, you know, friction feeling inside. I want that again.
Yeah, he wanted something feel good. Yeah.
I think there's something about contemporary, like, we don't have enough kind of vulgarity in movies anymore. Mm-hmm. I think in a way, when we think about like the kind of great B movies, the things that are just like, you want that kind of out of control, unintentional, like the excess that is just too much. And I think that things are so cooked and cooked and cooked again in the remaining studio system, which is barely a studio system anymore, but you know, we now have a few studios left, that it just feels like there's, you know, the possibilities for derangement are almost nil.
Right.
You know?
Well, even the possibilities for camp, and I think the reason that this movie maybe
that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's very that, yeah, yeah. Is, but it doesn't quite for me ever really become camp. Like it almost
well,
does.
Well, not in the way that we want it to. But right. I mean, like, but
the promise of camp.
I think
camp nip. If
the
you
fact
will.
That it
for the win.
Thank
I think
you,
what you want, Manola, is like for the movie to be kind of like to embrace its own badness or whatever, and that's a different kind of camp from the idea that they chose like an Oscar, you know, friendly
yes.
director.
They
and
wanted
all
respectability,
these actors,
right.
and they went for prestige, and
right.
that's where you get the aspect of camp that it does achieve is that it was made in all seriousness.
Oh yes,
know?
That's
and,
true.
Well,
the unintentional,
the, choice,
the kind of unintentional vulgarity.
And the CGI choice of it was another one of those situations where, like, I think you'd want to see real costumes. You'd want to see like. You'd want to see the vulgarity, the possible camp vulgarity of something that looks like a tactile costume, not a CGI digifer, which to me CGI is now like the warm bath of tools and movies, where it just lulls you into like, you know, wanting to fall asleep. And I think if they had made Cats a physical effects movie, you'd had the chance.
I do prefer the CG in Cats to the CG in The Irishman. I'd rather you do to people what Tom Hooper does than what Martin Scorsese did.
There's something so deeply wrong about mentioning those movies in the same sentence, but I'm just going to kind of...
I would watch Cats again first.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
I didn't say it was
fighting words.
Wow. Because, look, I've seen The Irishman twice, and neither time did the CG stuff with the faces ever take me out of it.
Absolutely.
Like it never made, although, somebody did this thing where they said, boy, the animation from Tintin really holds up, and they had three people from Tintin and then Robert De Niro.
Oh, dear.
And I was like, and in that context, it was like, oh, okay, that looks weird.
Well,
but
yeah.
But in the context of the movie, it worked for me.
The irony about The Irishman, except for how Peter sees it, is that the CGI, we all thought the CGI would be distracting. What ended up being distracting was really the actual physical ages of the actors when they were trying to be like 40 and making movements that made them definitely look their age. So,
right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
All that stuff, I just washed over me as I was into the movie.
Well,
because
I just was watching the movie.
Exactly,
I wasn't really thinking
yeah.
it was one
it
of those.
It took me about 5 minutes to settle into.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
This is the way that this is going to look And then I forgot about it.
Yeah, it took me about 2 hours and 45 minutes. But that's, that's when they sort of catch up with their actual ages, I think.
Now, a thing that has come up every year when we've had this conversation is, like, you know, the impact of Netflix and, you know, how Netflix is changing how we look at movies. And, you know, we've always talked about, you know, yes, the theatrical experience is obviously the sort of the apex of this kind of thing. But Mark Harris made an observation that was really interesting, where he said that for all the complaints people can have about Netflix, like, people on Twitter were talking about The Irishman and were talking about Marriage Story in a way, in the numbers that you don't usually see for, like, R-rated movies aimed at adult audiences.
Well, at the same time as what you're saying, because it was about when they had the fact that they all came out at once. Yeah.
But if those same movies had been released theatrically, they wouldn't have necessarily spawned the same kind of online discussion that they did, because so many people watched them at home.
I'm not really sure if I agree with that, but it's an interesting point. But I think we would all be talking about a Scorsese movie that reunited him with some of his most famous stars. I really don't believe that that would have been him having the same kind of arguments about it. I don't think that Netflix added anything to that. I mean, I think maybe,
except they got it and they made it.
Right.
No, I think we would have still been talking about Scorsese if somebody else had made that movie, never mind Netflix. I mean, I think that the one reason that we talk a lot about Netflix is because everyone in the media that I understand is obsessed with Netflix. And I understand why, because the movie industry is obsessed with Netflix. You know, they're spending money like nobody's business. I mean, all the ads, I mean, you know, thank you, Netflix. I guess they're paying for my mortgage in part, but.
You know. Wait, you don't get direct checks from them? I do.
Yeah, really. Oh, they've replaced Marvel as our direct deposit, you know.
Right, exactly.
Netflix for me is like, I think I've said this in my, I may have said this last year, is Netflix is Miramax in the way that it, the kind of mind share that it kind of, it seems to be driving conversations. It seems like the biggest player. It's throwing money out. Maybe that money will run out one of these days. Ooh. Who knows?
Part of the mystery of this is that eternal sort of, you know, thing about Netflix that they don't share realistic figures about who's watching. And when they do share it, I don't believe it. You know, whatever it was that, like, 80 bajillion people watched the first 70% of Irishman. It's like the but I do think, just anecdotally, you know, offline, because I find Twitter to be coming too toxic for me to spend too much time there. Instead of engaging in conversations, I kind of use it as a one-way channel, unfortunately. But like the talking to, you know, to relatives, friends, just, you know, people at the bus stop or whatever it is you do, you know, the you're seeing that everyone is watching these movies because they can, as part of a fixed subscription thing. And, you know, there really is this penetration. I remember this with Roma last year, where, you know, I kind of was in the Inland Empire, and, you know, my Latinx relative was telling me that he'd watched it kind of by himself on Netflix in Hesperia, California, or whatever. Mm. And, you know, that was a game changer. And so I do think, what's happening, if you combine the promotion that Manola's talking about with the access that people, because everybody seems to subscribe to this, is it's driving people to do this thing where they run out and watch things on opening weekend. You don't have to. I mean, those things are going to be on Netflix for months and months and months. But it is driving the kind of water cooler opening weekend kind of conversations that we used to get with theatrical films.
I think with Irishman and Marriage Story, forgive me, I now have a Hall's Honey Lemon cough drop in my mouth. The fact that they both arrived on Thanksgiving weekend may have provided a bit of logistical, you know.
I think Marriage Story might have been a little later.
Maybe a little later.
Yeah.
Well, Irishman was definitely Thanksgiving weekend. And so people had 4 or 5 days
of trying not to talk to each other.
To sit down and look at a thing. And I think that may have helped that groundswell that you're talking about.
Sure.
But I think because of, you know, these two films, I think eventually they would have, you know, maybe not in a big burst, but they would have eventually found that conversation online.
Right.
Yeah, but by contrast, is anyone talking about the Tyler Perry movie that launched, you know, 3 days ago? It's like, I didn't even know it was coming. It's like, because they're so disorganized in that respect, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he's actually one of the few filmmakers who does get this stuff like out into theaters in a big way. So like, I'm actually kind of surprised that he's even doing a deal with Netflix, because I think his movies have pretty you know, they've maintained a pretty steady profitability.
I've been paying attention. They don't open as strongly as they used to.
Yeah, yeah. And but he's still
the wave of his popularity has sort of
and
crested.
He is thinking about. I think he is thinking about the person who doesn't have access to a movie theater. Mm. He's probably thinking about that person more than another.
Yeah, we were just at the Lafka dinner. I was in a conversation with Mary Kay Place, who we gave our Best Actress to, and somebody brought up the whole notion of like, oh, did it bother her that people were seeing her film streaming? She's like, no, she's I'm from Tulsa. And like so many towns in Texas and Oklahoma, the theater's closed. And you got to drive an hour to see like a big Hollywood movie. You'd have to drive several hours to see some small indie like this. So, you know, I think that access matters and does count for people. It's also interesting that Netflix is, you know, they had made some talk about buying The Egyptian. I don't know if that's where that is.
Yeah, that's happening.
I mean, they already bought the Paris in New York. Yeah.
So, like, they are at least, you know, having some foothold into theatrical.
It will be interesting to see after the Oscars because, unfortunately, now I guess the end of the year conversation so dovetails with the Oscar conversation. Mm. Is if they walk away with not very much after spending so much to try to win. I mean, they're spending money to try to win Oscars.
Sure, and it didn't work with the Globes.
And
I mean,
it didn't
empty-handed from that show. And as we know, if you can buy an award, the award to buy is the Golden Globes.
And you know, it's like, Producers Guild just gave their award, unfortunately, to 1917, and that's seen as a kind of a marker of like what might win Best Director or certainly Best Picture down the line.
Because when Irishman, what the conversation was, oh, that was going to be the safe choice for Academy members after people were wondering if movies like Parasite or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood could get Best Picture. And now The Irishman isn't looking as safe as 1917 is for these Academy members.
I mean, it's got prestige with a capital P, all sewn up, classy accents and all.
Fancy British people and camera tricks and old wars.
Nothing like war to bring everybody in Hollywood together.
But like, I mean, like, it's this kind of thing where if that wins and then we go back and look at the kind of like the Miramax era of things when Saving Private Ryan loses to Shakespeare in Love, it's like it just feels like there's no justice in this kind of newly, you know, rigged to be more woke Academy.
The Oscars are just always a nightmare, basically. But it is funny that, like, you know, we're looking at Sam Mendes again when, you know, 20 years ago, you have these books coming out now about, 1999, this year of bold innovation in cinema is the year of, you know, being John Malkovich and you know, Pi and you know, the Blair Witch Project and, you know, The Sixth Sense, all these da-da-da. And then, you know, American Beauty wins Best Picture. And one of the movies that American Beauty beats out is The Cider House Rules, which is like as futzy as you can get. And of course, it's a Miramax movie, you know. Yeah. So yeah, the cycle just never ends. Now, the idea, though, that Parasite is a player in this award season is like, I think it's easy to take that for granted, but if you step back, that's like, that's shocking.
No, I'm not taking that for granted. Yeah, I think that's an
And that speaks to what you were saying earlier, Alonzo, about unpredictability, as I think that the reason it's people responding to it is they're seeing something that they've, a story that they've never seen before, a totally original film that's like pulling them in one direction and this, and like over the course of its running time, and you know, it gives me hope that like more filmmakers should look at that and go like, I should write something original, or I should make an original story that nobody's going to know what it is until they see it.
Right.
Well, it also says that, like, you know, this may be the big advance of the newly broadened international kind of leaning more female, more diverse Academy, is that we may finally get to see more and more foreign films and films that kind of don't hew to the strict Hollywood rules get in there. It doesn't seem to be working in terms of diversity or you know, the sort of gender representation. But again, I mean, that's almost a separate question. I think a lot of people are looking to the awards to lead when the awards are almost like the last stop.
It's the end of the assembly line.
In fact, the Parasite is still in theaters. It grossed $25 million.
Yeah, Parasite is like definitely, that is a reflection of the strength of that film. There have been other foreign films that get in, but it's also, I think, you know, a sign that, you know, the changes in the rules and the changes in the membership are opening up the possibility for foreign.
The other factor I agree with that is that I think that mainstream American movie making, I mean, like, let's look at the studios. So, because one of the tragedies of last year was that the Disney acquisition of Fox went through, and and also just want to say, just for people who don't know, that there is a separation. What happened is that Disney bought all the TV and film assets from Fox, and they call them assets, quote unquote, And Fox News is a separate entity. The Murdochs still have that. They spun off the TV and film, and Disney bought it.
And they have the TV network, too, the Fox channel.
Yes, right, that's what I'm saying. So, but now, and now Disney is going to get rid of the Fox name for whatever reason. I don't actually think it's because they see the association with Fox News. I think it's just that Disney puts its brand on everything. I think it's a branding thing. It's a universal brand. And I think what you've seen is a kind of shrinking down of the choices that come from just also the mainstream movie industry, particularly the studios. You know, I mean, Disney doesn't make very many movies, makes maybe a dozen a year. I mean, Paramount is struggling. You know, Warner Brothers is the only one that has any sort of really robust kind of lineup every year. So we're actually getting this incredible contraction happening with the studios and what's being offered. They're not making movies that win Oscars, that's been really kind of outsourced to the independent sector for a while. So I think there's a combination of things. I think it is definitely the opening up of who's in the Academy. It's now, I think, 9,000 or more people, and only a couple years ago it was 6,000 or 5,000. And it's many more people from outside the country, which I think is fantastic. So yes, but I also think it's the contraction of what's happening at the mainstream.
That's a great point. And it's also this sort of like where Netflix is poised to excel, because they're producing a lot of garbage. Miss Tyler Perry movie we just mentioned, but it's like but
every month
they are also doing a few of these kind of big prestige awards, and more than a few. You know, it's like we'll see a bunch of them start their cycle at Sundance in a week. You know, they have something like 8 or 9 films in the festival, and then they close out the season with The Irishman's and the Marriage Stories. And because they are not getting serious adult drama competition, you know, ambitious filmmakers are now being drawn to Netflix to do their projects.
Well, and also from what you hear, and I'm sure you've heard it, but what I've heard is they're just paying everyone over their quote. I've heard is they're just paying everyone over, like, by millions, you know? Just like somebody is like, oh, this is my quote. Oh, yeah, we're going to give you this, because they want to be in business.
And they're going to kind of ruin the model for everybody, because I don't think that's sustainable. I don't know if they're going to make Scorsese's next film, and then what does he do, you know, after he's been spoiled in his way. They're overpaying them, and they're giving them, you know, director's cut. And if I have, you know, one big gripe with The Irishman, is that I think he works better when producers are forcing him into the discipline of, you know, a tighter, kind of more focused running time.
I think Netflix is doing what they're doing, obviously, better than Annapurna has been doing what they're doing not necessarily in the aesthetic half of it, but in the business half of it.
That's a pretty big, I would put Annapurna up against Netflix any day. It doesn't mean, financially, whatever, but it does. At least, you know, they can be proud of what they have.
Sure,
Netflix is producing product.
Right. Sure, yeah. But I think Netflix has a running business model that makes sense to some extent for a while anyway, whereas Annapurna seems to have, like, burned out really quickly because they were throwing huge amounts of money after movies, like, that were great but were never going to be profitable.
I don't know if y'all recently saw the director's roundtable that happened. It was online. I can't remember now who conducted this, but Lulu Wang was in this roundtable, and I think you and I discussed this already once on maybe last week's show or the week before, but maybe we didn't. I can't remember anymore what we say on the mic and what we say just to each other. But the one of the things that she talked about was A24 paid like $6 million. For The Farewell.
Mm-hmm.
And she revealed during this roundtable that a major online streaming service.
I wonder who that could be.
That she did not name, offered her 12. And she took,
that was not Amazon. I
and everybody told her, take the 12, take the 12, take the 12. And she said, no.
Yep.
Because if I do that, I become part of their brand. I don't get to be me, and I don't have the luxury of already being Martin Scorsese. I have to establish myself and my name out there. And if I go with these other people, I get to do that. I get to build myself
super smart
in a different way, and the proof is that this film is still in theaters.
But also, you know, what also might have happened had she gone with a giant streaming service,
is that shall remain nameless.
But what you also hear about this giant streaming service is that sometimes the, you know, if they'd bought that movie and didn't think it was awards worthy, they might not have pushed it. Right. And I think they do that with certain movies, especially not in the narrative, but sometimes in the documentary categories, they're buying up movies. And if they decide that that's not the one that they're going to win an award with, they're not going to do much to push it.
What's interesting to me is, like, people used to give Miramax, rightly so, a lot of grief for buying titles and just, like, kind of parking them. And, you know, they wouldn't always necessarily release them or just dumping them.
Just take them off the tape.
Right, don't really hear that same kind of criticism. I mean, I think part of what's, like, the Netflix effect is so big right now that there's no almost criticism that can be mounted about it, you know? And you don't – I mean – you know, it's
well, those,
like,
movies do wind up out there, but they sometimes wind up orphaned
or
promoted.
But what does out there mean?
What does out there mean?
It's just because there's a release or it's in the, your Netflix crew,
right? If nobody
queue
knows,
next to some really terrible, like, you know, TV show that I would never watch.
I know of filmmakers who have I've heard of filmmakers who have
you reviewed something for me that was the second film from some indie person. Like it's some sort of like kind of a caper movie or something.
Give me the loot.
They had a second film that Netflix picked up and just buried.
But I mean, like a short doc, people will have their movies bought and because Netflix is so eager to, like, you know, win a short doc Oscar that, you know, they'll sometimes buy a movie and then you don't want to hear about it.
But
and
like
that
look
filmmaker
at...
will they'll come back to that filmmaker again and the filmmaker's like, fool me once. No, I'm
but
not.
Like, look at Amazon. They were the ones who spent like more than $50 million at Sundance last year, and they couldn't really make any of those films work. And they're good films are better than studio release films. At least, you know, if we're talking about like Late Night or Britney Runs a Marathon or The Report.
I like Late Night.
Again, like, I'm just using the point of comparison being the equivalent kind of, you know, summer.
I mean, and talk about people who want to get on the awards. Like, how many For Your Consideration ads did you see for The Aeronauts? Like
everywhere.
And no one cared about that movie.
Yeah, I know.
That movie is terrible. But
there's a reason.
I didn't even see it.
But I mean, I don't know if Lulu Wang gets to make that decision, or I mean, because she has producers and financiers. I mean, it's obviously a more complicated thing, and I don't know if it was, you know, we're talking Netflix or Amazon, but it's
like, who you like.
I love the idea though that she's thinking long term and she's thinking health of her career. And for me, A24 is the great hero of the last couple of years.
Absolutely.
I mean, that would have been an acquisition, but they are developing talent. They're working with, you know, young, really visionary, outside the box directors, and not all these movies are connecting. My favorite movie of the year was Waves, and that movie barely got seen.
Yeah.
It did a million and a half or something.
But A24 does feel like they have a point of view. And it's like the way, I think, in a way, before Miramax got too swamped into Oscar bait, you know, when they were...
Before the Cold Mountain years.
Exactly. Right. When they were like the sort of the Pulp Fiction Clerks studio, you know, you got excited because you're like, okay,
it's an auteur-driven company. I think I think it's very much like we're about directors, and these directors are not just giving us product.
Right.
Because, I mean, I think again, I may seem very anti-Netflix, but if they make a good movie, that's fine. Or often they buy movies. I can't stand that it's a Netflix original thing. Just drives me crazy. Though, of course, HBO did that same thing. But it's they're not. It's like they did not.
Meaning that they put that label even on movies they acquired.
Well, that's Roma. They didn't make Roma. Right, that just drove, you know, that was crazy. But I think the thing is that we just have to remember that Netflix is basically everything is about their subscribers. That is the only point of Netflix. They are just doing that. They're not, you know, and yes, you can say other companies are doing, they want to make money as well. But I actually do believe like a company like A24 actually cares about the people that they're, they really do. I mean, they have great taste.
You know, and frankly,
great taste
I think,
is big.
And they've also figured out like a way to sort of like be profitable without diluting their reputation for having good movies is to take their kind of crappy ones and premiere them on DirecTV.
Mm-hmm. It's a very smart company.
Yeah,
it's
they know what they're doing.
And I'm glad they're there.
So, all right, lest we get too mired in just talking about the corporate half, let's talk about the movies that we actually liked in 2019, like what we got excited about and what, you know, I was not in any way prepared for how much I loved Little Women. You know, I didn't think I needed another adaptation. I didn't know that it was going to be... I didn't know what she was going to do to it. And I was blown away by Greta Gerwig's choices, by the way that movie flows, by the performances, by the way that she told me a story that I've heard a million times before, but told it, I think, better in a lot of ways.
And just with a lot of comedy, that's something that she really brought to it. But yeah. Carry on, I didn't.
Well, no. But just like the, you know, the Laurie's marriage at the end always strikes me as weird in almost every adaptation. It feels like it's not really set up. It feels like everybody's sort of getting their second choice. And then but here we get like two or three scenes that lead up to it. It's like, okay, no, I see now why this character and that character are getting together. And like, that's a thing in an adaptation that you do to like kind of fix, you know, that's a dramaturg choice, I think, and that she does really well.
She treats this material as if like somebody would look at Shakespeare. I mean, it's like, and that is like, it's like a revelation. I mean, it makes you think of all the different adaptations that of books that we could get now that are just are where at the core is something that has always been there, but you everything around it you can kind of mess with.
But that new reader brings something new to the text. Yes. I mean, she brought something new, and I mean, I think it's a beautiful movie. I loved it. The thing I remember watching it, I was sitting at Sony watching it, and I'm like, why am I crying? Oh my God, I'm crying. And then I didn't stop crying. I mean, it was just
like, no, Bibbs and I sat in the back row. People were filing out passes. We were just like,
well, and you also have like a really distinctive laugh, and I was sort of enjoying how much you were enjoying the movie. You know,
it was like filmmaking joy all throughout that movie. I remember the first time I was going, this is joy. This is the joy of filmmaking, like in every single minute. Every frame is like she's showing you exactly what she wants to show you, and it's coming from her, and it's just alive. The whole thing was alive.
And I was thrilled that American audiences finally get a chance to understand that Louis Garrel has the best hair, eyebrows, and nose of cinema.
Oh, can I?
You mean my boyfriend?
Can I inject? I caught up because I went to Paris over the holidays, and while I was there, I caught up with the Roman Polanski movie because I have no confidence that movie will come out in the country. And they cast Louis Garrel as Dreyfus in the Dreyfus Affair, and they've shaved his head and put this horrible wig on, and they've kind of disguised and you know like
seems
made
really
him.
Wrong to me.
Why would you do that?
Like, I'm having little palpitations.
I mean, he's a great actor, but he's like, you know, the wrong choice for that. And it's the wrong thing to do to him. You know, it's like he's one of those people. You wouldn't shave Timothée Chalamet's hair.
No.
You know?
I reviewed the movie that he directed that came out this past year. And it's
I like the movie.
It's a very charming little movie. Absolutely. You know, it's got that kind of like early 70s French thing going that's really,
It's like him and two women, right?
Well, it's Lea Costa, who's one of his wives or has been or whatever, and Johnny Depp's daughter.
And who was
Johnny Depp's daughter?
We don't know about polygamy. It's kind of an unusual thing.
And it's written by, I'm blanking on his name, but the great French screenwriter
Jean-Claude
Carrière. Thank you.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. And now, Peter, you cover the animation beat a lot, and I feel like I missed this year. Like I feel like a lot of the small, like I haven't seen I Lost My Body yet. I haven't seen like Promare and like a lot of the Japanese films that people.
Well,
were
you
talking
can skip
about.
Promare, but like it was a great year for animation, and it was also the sort of year that gave us the finale to the How to Train Your Dragon series, which for me is like the only truly artistic animation property to come out of. DreamWorks, who's so focused on the commercial side of things and the please the shareholders side of things, and here was like a you know a real arc that crossed three movies and sort of like saw the characters grow up and old and apart and all these kind of things and you know so I mean that movie's I think fantastic. The I think Laika, you know, who does these stop motion films with the really unusual technology where they're kind of half computer done. The part that is half done is they're printing the faces instead of like sculpting them or whatever. And,
oh, wow. Okay.
You know, doing so every expression you see is kind of a different face that's been digitally printed with one of these 3D printers. I mean, it's the most excruciatingly painstaking work. And, you know, Missing Link is just as gorgeous as that has gotten.
But is
them.
It good?
I mean, that movie to me is not their strongest, but it is gorgeous. And I mean, it's just stunning. And you would think, I think people, audiences would go in thinking they're watching a CG movie, not realizing how great their hand-tooled, you know, work has gotten. Yeah. That
So they're doing it too well, basically.
Yeah. And I'm not going to go through everything, but like I love Toy Story 4. I didn't.
Sure.
I'm the sort of weird outlier who felt like Toy Story 3 wasn't the movie I wanted until maybe the last 10 minutes.
Leave this house.
And those last 10 minutes are about him finally giving away Woody, and and there's even kind of like, you know, did he give away Woody? Is he in the box? Whatever. Toy Story 4, I think, picks up on what I thought that film was going to explore, and I loved, you know, how cinematic it was. It's widescreen, and the animation's gorgeous.
It was all right.
And of course, I Lost My Body, which is, you know, a Netflix original because they bought it and put their name on it, but they didn't make it. It's a really, the idea that that movie exists blows my mind. It's the story of like a guy whose severed hand, we don't even know. It's a severed hand who has to basically figure out how it came to be detached from its owner. Is the owner alive? Does the owner still need that hand? You know, what does it
And it goes
remember?
On an adventure across Paris.
It's
the
crazy.
Hand.
Yeah.
It fights with a bird. It's crawling up.
Fending off rats.
I liked it. I wanted to like it more, but I liked it.
I mean, that movie plays exactly.
It's very handsome looking. I mean, the animation is.
And I mean, it's CG underneath, but it's kind of hand drawn on top, so it looks like a
It doesn't have that kind
movie.
Of like kind of weird like polish thing. But it feels too seamless, you know. Yeah.
I love movies like that though, where you throw me into a situation or a world where you don't know the rules. Like, I mean, what can a hand that's separated from its body do? Does it have strength? Does it have sight?
Could have done
more. Memory? It's like, and you have to, like, the filmmaker has to communicate how gravity works in this new kind of environment.
So what did you like this year, Manuel? What excited you?
I wish that more people loved Pain and Glory, the Almodóvar. I adore that movie, and it just feels like it kind of fell away for people, you know. That was the movie that I had the you know, was my number one. I don't, you know, the paper really likes us to, you know, number our, otherwise I would just put everything in alphabetical order, honestly, but it was one of my favorite movies, and I think it's just a really, I was deeply, deeply moved by it, but I also think that I think it's his best movie in a very long time.
Do we think that Americans only respond to Almodóvar when he goes big?
Garish.
Like,
big emotions, or big laughs. I wonder, that this felt, and the way that people talked about it, somehow they were disappointed, and I just thought, you're giving this incredibly beautiful, heartfelt, I mean, I think Banderas is amazing
in this movie.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm so,
just blows my mind that a Todd what's his name? Todd. What's his?
Phillips.
Yes, I can't even say his name. That anything he would touch with that would take away. I mean, I like Joaquin Phoenix. I don't like the performance in Joker, but I think there's no comparison between these performances.
No, and as much as I think the Oscars are nonsense, I'm delighted that Banderas is having this moment
of people
acknowledging what a great performance.
They're nonsense when they get it wrong.
There you go.
I'm glad you love that movie. I do too, and I love it more than Paris. I mean, it's apart from Waves, which I mentioned, it's the next, you know, most. And it's hard to number these things. I mean, it's like I love them differently, and I think it is his. It's not my favorite Almodóvar film, but it is, I think, his best. It's the one where it all kind of comes together, and it's like that sort of that respectability drag that he was doing with. I mean, it's not that those movies weren't great, but you know, the kind of like All About My Mother era where he was kind of doing a prestige version of his flamboyance, and it was kind of getting more like that has kind of blossomed into this maturity that I see here. And I see this movie as like his second coming out.
It's deep. It's a
He's
very
like sharing
deep
this
film.
Thing about all of the pain and all of the physical kind of obstacles to being the artist that we have loved all these years. And so it gives you the key to reread his entire filmography with added
really
information.
Nice, really
and
nice.
Weirdly, it is all about his mother.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
In a way that film, which I also love, like, I mean, this one, I think he really kind of gets into the good parts and the not so good parts of their relationship. And
that ending just destroys me.
It makes you wonder if people, if more people had gone in having seen like all his movies, they would have had more of an appreciation for it. I mean, maybe it hasn't struck that deeply because not enough people know his filmography to
true
to kind of
it's an
see
acquireder key
yeah.
you know it's an acquireder yeah. key I think it's yeah. a very it, and it's a it, it's doing something very kind of elegant and subtle too in terms yeah. of it's talking about like how you it's pain and glory the transformation of life into art it's an astonishing movie so.
Yeah I got to interview him about it and we talked about you know how this movie is sort of his the manifestation of his fear of one day not being able to make movies, mm. of being physically unable to mm-hmm. because of whatever, you know, ailments. And I brought up John Huston directing The Dead.
Mm-hmm,
you know, that
mm-hmm.
picture of him where he's in the wheelchair.
Tethered like, to his oxygen tank.
Yes, and all the tubes coming out of him. He goes, oh, because I almost used that picture in the movie. Like, that's such a powerful image to me, the idea of, like, John Huston it, with his last breath still directing.
Absolutely. You know? I'm still here, and I'm going to make great art. No, it's an extraordinary movie.
Robert, any favorites we haven't touched on for you?
I mean, look, I could talk about documentaries because I saw so many of them this year, and I think it was an incredible year for documentaries. There were three in my top 10, including like American Factory, again,
yes.
Netflix. But,
and again, they did not produce
that
movie.
Well, but
that
was
I
part
just
of their deal
say,
with Obama, wasn't
right.
it?
That was,
no,
Obama came out after.
After.
Yeah. He
oh,
came
okay,
after.
Gotcha.
This was a participant.
They were making this movie for many, many years.
Yeah.
Okay.
No,
as that
this
early footage shows you, they were there like when the plant closed. So, so the American Factory about the plant and the auto plant in Dayton, Ohio, that's purchased by a Chinese billionaire and just what happens when you know the cultures you know have to work together and you find out certain things about how a business is done in two different worlds
right and, I mean
and,
I think it's very
yeah,
much a
it's,
movie about
it's,
capitalism
it is,
and
absolutely.
Also about contemporary capitalism and also the weakening of unions I just want to
right.
say this that I you know the for me in terms of the culture clash was less about like American way of doing things and Chinese way of doing things it's about a certain kind of capitalist
new economy versus
and not having union strength, you know.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah, it's, capitalism has cultures. I mean,
yeah,
it's like it definitely, and that's what this movie made starkly clear. And Honeyland, which was I know people have talked a lot about Honeyland, but it is truly an extraordinary movie and about a lonely Macedonian beekeeper, practically the last person in her village except for her and her mom, and what happens when a family comes in to try and horn in on her business, and it's really an extraordinary. Again, like both these movies, American Factory and Honeyland, are kind of classic documentaries in the sense that the filmmakers were there for a long time. They shot and shot and shot, and like probably didn't know what kind of movie they would have, and then all of a sudden the story presents itself, and they're like, "Whoa!" And you get that story, and those are two great ones. And so those are
first film to be nominated for foreign film and doc.
I love time. Apollo 11 too. Just I mean,
that's a wonderful movie.
It was such a different documentary. Yeah, you had like one of the great like found footage, or not found footage, but more like archival documentaries in a long time with Apollo 11. Yeah, I mean, it's just been like
no, it's great.
It's been a great
mention One Child Nation
and One Child Nation,
which is a really great movie, real activist movie about reproductive rights, by Nenfu Wang and I'm going to massacre her name, but Jialing Zhang. Really, really terrific movie. People should watch.
Terrific,
a
devastating.
A tough movie to watch.
Did you guys see The Hottest August? That was
I did.
Like the one that made my top 10. But it's almost because it so excited me, the idea that I think documentaries have so excelled in the last years. But like when people are doing something almost like with the language of documentary formally, and it's not that this is a difficult movie, but it's like her premise was, let's go in for a month and interview New Yorkers, the ones that interest me, and then let's somehow in the editing construct a time capsule of where this would have been August 2017, and it's right before the Charlottesville kind of incident and
like post-election but pre like some of the
Right. And there's already this kind of, you know, so, I mean, and it's touching on anxieties like global warming and like, you know, where our universe and country are headed. You know?
And I haven't seen Edge of Democracy, but I know that's
one
that people were talking about, too.
We're just seeing a lot of, I think, different kinds of documentary that it feels like, you know, there are just so many different ways of expressing things, which is really exciting.
Yeah, essayistic, people, you know, recreations, you know, it's like, I mean, everyone's just playing around with everything right now. And I love it because it's helping people understand that, you know, documentaries aren't, you know, they don't necessarily have to be like educational. They don't necessarily, you know, they certainly don't have to be like, you know, just, you know, movies about issues that just like hammer a point home.
No, they're
home
personal
to you.
Expressions.
It can be personal expressions. It can be artistic. And
that's why I really liked hottest August, because as a climate change documentary, it could have just been, well, here are more inconvenient truths, you know, and instead it was regular people telling their stories and sharing their feelings about what this is, what's going on in their lives related to this subject. And that kept me involved in a way that, you know, scientists are saying we're all going to die. I already know that, you know.
What was that Italian film that was, I thought it was Oscar nominated, The Fire, the one about all the refugees who are coming to the island. But like what I saw in common is that you see like the real subject is kind of happening in the background or invisibly, and everybody's just dealing with the way that on a human level they're coping with all of the stresses, climate change being one of them, of modern life.
Yeah, so there's a great documentary like that called Island of Hungry Ghosts. That is
it
also
came out earlier this year.
That has an issue being presented, but not in any sort of, it's more in kind of an oblique fashion, about, you know, refugees. Or I'm sorry, like more like asylum seekers on Christmas Island in this detention center that Australia runs in the middle of this island that you can't find unless you go look it out, seek it out, and you kind of get some of their stories. And the filmmaker shot surreptitiously without the government knowing. So you got some of the stories of these people as they tell a therapist, and then you also see the therapist's life as she kind of like has to like take in these stories and just what it does to her, like her soul. And then at the same time, you get the story of these crabs and the migration of these crabs. And maybe the crabs are treated better than the humans.
Do we think
I was thinking of Fire at Sea, by the way, just to...
Yes, that's right.
Do we think enough time has elapsed since the 2016 election that we're seeing movies about the world with Trump in it? Or is that something that's still...
I am so sure that the reason that Lucretia Martel, a filmmaker I love and will never, ever, ever forgive.
For being president of the Venice jury that gave a Golden Lion to Joker?
Yes, indeedy. Right. I think that is a direct result of Trump. And I can't
believe that movie certainly is.
Is she trolling the
U.S.? No, I think that she looks at that movie and thinks, yes, America. I think that's absolutely this. I think that is absolutely the case. And being working for the New York Times, I can't say anything about Trump. I'm just saying I will never forgive Lucretia Martel, even though I adore her, because they set that movie on the road. I mean, you could say Venice set it on the road to legitimation, but by having it win, it definitely added. This is a movie that you have to take seriously.
Do we think, and just putting aside the specifics of Joker, which is a whole other topic, is this going to set off a thing now where filmmakers are going to use IP as kind of a cover to make a different kind of movie? In other words, like, you know, say, if assuming that you like Joker and you think that Todd Phillips is doing something interesting, you could make the case that he is using this sort of DC Comics related, you know, title and name and connection to make his little gritty, you know, individual
ersatz Scorsese movie.
Exactly. Yes. So I'm just saying, do you see other filmmakers maybe trying to be the thing like, okay, I'm trying to make this little gritty drama about this person, and people aren't going to care. But if I call this movie Catwoman, now suddenly, you know, I can sell it.
That's
you know?
What you're saying.
Well, it's the Trojan horse. Look,
exactly, yeah. Or, like the poison pill that you're slipping into what otherwise seems like a superhero movie.
Is that why Chloe Zhao wants to make a Marvel movie? Because she has this idea that she's going to maybe do something different. I mean, maybe that is a reason why people meet with Marvel and talk about
it. Or maybe they're getting paid a lot of money. Ooh. I don't know.
Well, I mean, Ava DuVernay is still doing New Gods, right, for DC, for Warner Brothers? Yeah, I mean, yeah.
And the director of this Harley Quinn movie, whose name just literally the second ran out of my head, did Dead Pigs. You know, it's like another really interesting filmmaker. That movie has never come out in the States for some reason. But I mean, like, these are. I gather that Marvel is meeting with all these people. Like, Kent Jones told me that
Lucretia Martel met with Marvel. Yeah, no,
Claire
I know.
Denis,
I
would it's really like,
love and then saw Joker and thought, well,
the
I don't
audio
know.
Of that meeting.
And so it's interesting that like there are people who are maybe seeing this as a way to kind of, you know, it's a little bit like there's an element of the Netflix thing where if you know that your movies are going to be seen, will you accept a certain compromise in order to sort of still get your...
But why are we talking about in terms of like getting your movie seen? How about like, I'm going to get a lot of money and I'll do that. I mean, well, I can't even... like, why do we think anyone else... I mean... we have, you know, a Thor movie, and then we have Jojo Rabbit. I mean, I think that he, you know, Waititi definitely, do we think, yeah, I'm sure they think, oh, this will be fun. This will be really big, expensive play, you know, kind of playground, and I'll have a good time. But why are we pretending that people don't do this for money?
Well,
but,
and I would think after I would think after Edgar Wright getting fired by Ant-Man, that if I were an auteur, I would think twice about believing that Marvel was interested in me bringing my weirdness to the table.
I do think it's
because they are not interested in you bringing your weirdness to the table at all. You, what they're going to do is, like, you're going to bring a little bit of spice.
Yeah.
You know, but then we've got all these other directors who are going to do the action stuff and the CGI. And remember, you have to have a battle every 5 minutes.
Well, is it money and also, like, being noticed in
power.
Hollywood?
I mean, I think it's money and power. I'm sure it's money and power.
There is something, there is like a very specific kind of equation that exists in the industry right now, and it's sort of like it's calculating like a worst case scenario for a movie of yours that is a Jojo Rabbit. Like if you're pitching that movie and or an adaptation of something, you know, they will kind of run the numbers and they'll look at how your movies have performed as a director, how the actors' movies will perform.
So if you made a $1 billion movie that happens to be a Marvel committee film, but your name is on it,
absolutely,
that's still your
and
billion.
Absolutely.
Certain directors can get a movie made. I'm sure the Katz-Tom Hooper equation is based on other directors being considered and that not working out right. So when you have a megaton movie that helps your chances to then turn around. I mean, I don't love Jojo Rabbit, but that film's existence, that film's, you know, recognition at the Best Picture level as a nominee, all of those things to me are encouraging. The idea that something like that can somehow worm its way through a system where there's so many kind of like pitfalls to prevent that kind of thing.
Yeah, or you could be the guy who made Jurassic World and then turn around and do the Book of Henry. Like, you never know how it's going to go.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's not always like a win-win. But
no, it's
like,
not always a win-win. But I do think that provides, I think, you know, if we talk about legitimation, you know, in this sense, it's industry legitimation. Yeah. Because this is kind of magical thinking. Oh, that movie made $400 million. This person I can trust will do something that will.
I mean, to
make
me,
money.
The success story of this year, apart from Jojo Rabbit, in that is like, I don't love this movie, but like Knives Out. Like, Knives Out is probably not a movie Rian Johnson could have gotten made for having done a Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
True.
He probably could have made it with none of those stars. I mean, like, and just
much less expense. Less money. I think.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like on a brick level, basically.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't know. We're getting close to our time here. Do anybody any thoughts on the decade, or do we want to talk about the year ahead, or any other films?
So hang on down just a second.
Okay.
Before we get into the
Dave,
decade,
Dave has a question.
Okay.
Dave.
Before we get into the decade, here's what I liked the best of 2019.
Oh, thank you, Dave.
I've let all y'all talk.
Okay.
I love Transit.
Yay.
That was on my list.
It's on my top 10 too.
The Load, the Serbian film that came out this year.
Oh, yeah, that's a good movie.
The guy driving a truck.
Oh, yeah. There's some images in that movie that have stayed with me. Yeah.
Amazing. I liked Ray and Liz. Did anybody see Ray and Liz?
I did not like that.
I liked Ray and Liz because it felt like the closest thing to what it really feels like to grow up with an alcoholic family that is disintegrating slowly. And having experienced that in life, I was perhaps under-distanced from this film, but it was...
But you'd have known if they'd gotten it wrong.
I'm sorry?
But you would have known if they'd gotten it wrong.
He didn't get it wrong. Yeah. And so, you know, you can dislike the film, but it's comes from a place of deep experience. It's not easy to watch, but I loved it. I love Black Mother, the documentary from Kalikala.
Yeah, Black Mother's.
Hong Sang-soo's Hotel by the River.
Good movie.
Like came out in February. I was super into that. I love how quiet it is. Mm-hmm. And just in general, how quiet his movies are. And he makes one every other week. I really
sometimes the same one.
Wish that...
Oh, come on.
Sort of.
No, yeah, I mean, it's sort of his thing.
But that's what I find them comforting.
He's working things out.
I wish Todd Haynes' Dark Waters had had more that's attention.
That's a good movie that people just didn't bother
I sat through it thinking, we were just talking about all my weird allergies and the movie Safe before we turned the mics on. And I said this when it came out. This is like, safe to : she was right all along.
It's not in her head. Yeah. It's in the water, your air, everything that you're doing.
And so much of it, in terms of like how it is shot, reminded me of things from Safe. So it couldn't have been a mistake.
Like scenes of him walking down the hall when he's just like kind of got this like him, like this like
fidgety. Driving cars through parking garages, and I'm like, ah. I loved Us. I loved In Fabric, Peter Strickland movie about the haunted dress, and Fatma Muhammad as the sales lady. It was my queen of the year. I loved Happy Death Day to You.
Ooh, fun.
I don't know if y'all saw this.
No, missed that
it's
one.
It's a wacky sequel to Happy Death Day, the horror film, about a young woman who has to relive her own psychotic killer murder over and over and over
it's
again.
It's like one of these Groundhog Day
where she has to figure out a way to beat him. Delightful.
I will watch it.
And then they figure out a way to make a sequel to it.
An even crazier sequel. Yeah.
Involving quantum physics. My guilty pleasure like that was Ready or Not. I
Ready or Not was fun.
Yeah, fun whatever,
I had right. I liked it much better than Knives Out.
Agreed, yeah.
And I think Under the Silver Lake is a really great movie about a jerk in East Los Angeles.
You were on a roll, Dave, and now this.
It's a movie about you're a jerk and you don't know what a jerk you are. And that's what I like.
It's a movie
about
not knowing how to make a movie.
Okay. See, I think a lot of people, I'm not saying you, but a lot of people who don't like that movie think that the movie doesn't get what an a-hole its protagonist is.
That's not my problem with it. It's the whole movie that it's
It's weird. That movie, I mean, this is still like weird it. Arcana, but like that movie premiered back-to-back with Burning at Cannes. And weirdly, they are both movies about a-holes who sense that there's a mystery where there may not be one,
right.
And who kind of go out of their way to kind of create this
make
elaborate
life more complicated.
And have to figure out how they're at the center of it.
And one is a masterpiece, and one Dave likes.
I can live with that.
Can I also add how happy I was that Eddie Murphy?
Oh,
came back to us.
Oh, yeah.
We need more nice. Wesley Snipes, too.
Oh, my God, Snipes. Yes.
Wesley Snipes.
I see no reason to do
Come
it again.
On.
Everybody in that movie was wonderful.
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean,
was like an old-fashioned, R-rated, vulgar comedy where it wasn't about grossing you out. It was about making you laugh with vulgarity.
If you like that, go dig up Badass, which I feel like is a movie that about
Mario
Sweet
Man
Sweetback, you know, sort of that plays a lot of the same kind of pleasure points or whatever, and kind of fell by the wayside in its time.
Some of the best times I had at the movies this past year were Booksmart and Long Shot. Like, I was just sort of I just delighted in the banter, in the wit of it, in the, you know, like how briskly they both moved along and gave me these really wonderful characters that I engaged with. They both made me very happy.
I love Booksmart. Yeah,
Booksmart was wonderful.
And speaking of like banter, maybe the best conversation I had all year was with Olivia Wilde, who's just like has such an intelligent place that she's coming from, and she's making a really rowdy comedy, but I think she puts so much into it, and she does that smart thing a little bit like what we're saying with like Marvel movies of like if you're not articulating the politics necessarily, but they're there, and I think she's rewriting so much of the kind of what teenagers have been told by the movies to expect from the high school experience and, you know, kind of what you have to be to other people. And it's all about kind of challenging that for a generation, I hope.
Can I put in a word for another movie that did not get a lot of
Please.
Enough love? I love Transit, like Dave. I think people should watch. This is by Christian Petzold, German director. And I also really love Synonyms by an Israeli director named Nadav Lapid. It's a tough movie. It's a very abrasive movie. It's got a fantastic lead performance by Tom Mercier. It's sexy. It's funny. Sometimes it's like a parody of The Dreamers, the old Bertolucci movie. And it's about a young man who flees Israel in a way, trying to flee his identity as an Israeli. And he goes to Paris. And it's just a terrific movie. And it's not the kind of movie that, you know, is put out by a very small American distributor, so it didn't get a lot of attention, but I think it's terrific.
And it's sitting on our stack of screeners.
Sorry, it was on my top 10.
I gotta watch it.
Yeah, that was put out by Kino. I mean, it just as we shouted out to A24 earlier, I mean, Kino
Lorber
really...
is absolutely doing terrific work. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. We're so grateful for them.
And amazing DVDs and Blu-rays. Like, I mean, their commitment to new foreign theatrical is great.
It's great.
But like their classics division of what they're putting out on Blu-ray every month is astonishing.
Yeah, this year they put out a handful of Jean-Pierre Melville movies that had kind of fallen out of
circulation. They put out an Ida Lupino box. Yeah, like they're just amazing stuff from them. Because I don't know if you guys, Variety just announced that Universal and Warner Brothers are merging their home video departments, because that's how tiny the physical media business is now, that like these two studios are going.
And as we
together.
Go into a new year, this is just a little advice from all of us to everyone listening, is if you can, and if you can afford it, and if there is a sale, buy your DVDs, buy your Blu-rays, because this stuff is going to get harder and harder and harder for you to watch.
Yeah.
Streaming services are making it more and more difficult to actually get, you know, to see stuff when you want to see it. So actually buy. Everyone I know is buying DVDs. And
those rights don't last forever. I mean, I thought it was kind of amazing that Netflix is putting, or is allowing Roma to come out on Blu-ray from Criterion, which I thought was like
that's very interesting.
It's not unprecedented. A lot of their shows are out on DVD. I think they're not averse to physical.
Right. But it's
and Orange is the New Black. But
people
no,
need to know this.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, stuff is disappearing from Disney Plus, and the whole point of Disney Plus is that you own all of it. You know, and so these companies on a whim can just decide you don't get to see stuff anymore. So
don't exist anymore.
That's why I still write a column for The Wrap every month about physical media. I've been beating this drum, but thank you, Manola, for underscoring that. Because own this stuff. You cannot guarantee that you're going to get to see it when you want to. Otherwise,
and then learn
Monkeys
how to
go home see it, is not on Disney Plus. Awesome.
What's not on Disney Plus?
Monkeys Go Home is not on Disney
Plus.
Nor is
The Outrage.
The Boatniks, the North Avenue Irregulars. No.
Oh, well, Disney has had a long history of taking things away. I mean, that's part of its strategy.
And they took the F word out of Adventures in Babysitting.
That is so deeply wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's a crime against cinema.
But also go see these movies in theaters.
Absolutely.
When these things are being re-released, when they're being restored, where they're giving these... You know,
absolutely. Here,
chance,
here.
Yeah, I mean,
amen to that.
A lot of really good.
The White Sheik is out right now. The early Fellini film Rialto just did a 4K restoration out, and it's at the Royal.
Yeah, I mean, and we're getting theatrical releases of a lot of these. Mr. Klein, I saw last year. I mean, like that's just
Olivia,
one of
Olivia,
this
wonderful French movie from the early 30s.
I saw that at the Royal.
That was just wonderful. Babylon, this great. That had never actually been released in America.
Right, the reggae film. The Europeans just came out.
The Europeans. Oh, yeah, they're doing a lot of...
Merchant Ivory.
Cohen
media. Yeah, Cohen owns
early Merchant Ivory.
They own
movies.
The library. That's why they're doing that.
Nice.
You sparked my memory, though, about The Chambermaid, and I just wanted to elaborate in two sentences, because for me, that was the movie I kind of wanted Roma to be last year. It's not... by which I mean, I just thought that Roma wasn't coming from the point of view of this the maid in the household so much as the kind of appreciative.
It's a great companion piece to me.
I don't know that that makes Roma a bad movie, but I loved about Chambermaid that it's so much about the point of view of a working class woman, and she's surrounded by, she's kind of like, you know, as invisible or overlooked as the wallpaper, but she has access to the lives and private affairs of all the people in this Mexico City hotel.
It's a wonderful
and her movie. You know, her struggle. I love that movie.
Final thoughts?
Oh, wait, I want to know if maybe a question for the group. Did any film from last year make it onto your decade list?
I didn't, actually. When I did my decade list, I even said in the intro, I didn't do any 2019 films because I haven't sat with them long enough. But, like, you know, Little Women was my number one and Pain and Glory is my number two, and those were both close. But, yeah, I opted not to because I didn't have the same track record with thinking about and living with and sitting on these the way I have.
All my
films.
Decade movies I think I've seen several times, I've gone back and seen them again, you know. Mad Max Fury Road, one of the greatest movies ever made, instance.
That was on mine.
That's one of my decade movies.
I put three documentaries in my decade best.
Nice. I mean, this was a decade for documentaries.
Two.
As was the decade before. I mean, I think this is like the 21st century has really been.
No, I wanted to honor that with the day. I wanted to honor the huge leaps and bounds in documentaries.
Which three?
I put I Am Not Your Negro. No home movie.
The Chantal Ackerman, that's on my decade list as well.
And Tower.
Oh, interesting. Wow. Okay. That's right.
That spoke to me.
Is the stories we tell this decade? I think that for me was maybe Sarah Paulin.
Yeah. I think that's technically considered the first. Yeah. Movie. Okay. If you're going by the 2010, because I think it's a 2010 movie.
I wound up pointedly not putting Docs on the list, just thinking it would be a separate list. But like if I were to have put them, I mean, like I think Faces Places certainly would have been up there, and Minding the Gap.
Oh, that's a lovely
Money
movie.
Money in the Gap really came close for me to be being in the decade.
Yeah.
I did a really weird little niche decade list for the rap. Mm. My editor.
He looks over.
Assigned it to me. And so it wasn't, you know, this comprehensive thing, but two of them on this list, I would say, really stayed with me maybe permanently. And one of them was... Lav Diaz's The Woman Who Left.
Oh, it's a great movie.
And a documentary called Milford Graves' Full Mantis about the avant-garde jazz percussionist. This is free jazz percussionist. Grasshopper put it out 2018. They put it out in 2018. Wow. And it's wild. It is one of the most unusual and wildly structured and like a free jazz percussion solo itself kind of film. And he's just this, like, he's the coolest dude in the universe. And I saw it. I took friends. We talked about it on the show. And I don't know anyone who saw it. You know,
I will watch it this year.
The music hall, you know, the late lamented music hall is where you went to see things like that. And...
it lives again.
Okay, sure. It does. You're right. It does. It's they've reopened and hopefully they're going to do
new management.
Hopefully they're going to do more stuff like this.
Yes. Not the movie, but music hall.
One of the things that bothered me about when the music hall closed is everyone saying, "Well, they only did these four wall crappy movies there," and I'm like, "That's not true." And people saying, "You know, I never went there anyway," and I'm like, "Well, why not?
Yeah,
because I was there a lot.
We saw This Is Not a Film there.
I review the movies that show
this falling down dump of a theater that I could not love more. Dots at the concession stand." And they showed Milford Graves' Full Mantis.
No, for a three-screen theater, they would show like maybe seven different movies over the course of a week.
Yeah.
Where sometimes one, you know, maybe one movie got one showing a week, but another got like four. And I mean, there was the movie that thought would bring out audiences to the main theater. You know, it's like they were like a chugging along indie.
I've never asked you if you watched this because I put it as sort of an honorable mention on my decade list because it felt like too separate to count.
What if I haven't
count.
Seen it? Uh-oh.
Frozen?
No, maybe you haven't. I don't know. I bet you've seen part of it. Christian Markley's The Clock.
I actually never did see it. No.
Oh, wow.
No.
Did you see it all or did you
I watched the whole thing.
24 hours.
It took me four sittings.
I felt like I needed to see it, and the more that I felt like I needed to see it, the more that I had no interest in seeing it. I know that's terrible because so many smart people I'm looking at one saw it or saw a lot of it. I mean, you know, very... I just didn't. It's a terrible.
I saw four whole hours of it from 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. We went and got donuts.
I saw about 8 hours of it.
What I don't understand is, like, this year there were a couple of these long movies that I couldn't make it through. La Fleur, which showed
up on
people's list.
I couldn't finish it either. Yeah, the 14 hours.
They sent me the link, and I thought it's a long.
It's not 14 hours, but it's long.
Yeah,
I thought it was 14. Maybe I'm wrong.
But
it's over 13. I know that.
Maybe you're right. In my memory, it was more manageable. And then the elephant sitting.
I saw that.
Fleet 3.5 hours though.
Yeah. I rewatched that movie because we never reviewed it, and it's a painful experience. And I wanted to sort of get something down on the record, and so now I've seen that movie twice.
Wow!
And still haven't.
I've seen The Irishman twice.
We watched the Satin Tango.
Yes,
reissue.
We did.
Now that's a great movie.
Great.
You know, Elephant Sitting Still. I wanted to love it, and I just sort of admired it.
I put it in the category of Joker.
He died before he finished it. I mean, so that's a really, that's actually a really, I think, an important consideration.
He died related to the, I mean, his suicide note basically accuses his producers of, you know, compromising the vision of a young filmmaker. I mean, he seems to have thrown a very dramatic tantrum.
Ugh, that's horrible. I didn't know that.
I don't mean to like disrespect the thing, but I mean it seems to be related to.
But the point is,
that,
he didn't actually finish the movie, so it's hard to know.
You're
like,
judging an unfinished.
No, I mean we are. Yeah, he died before he finished cutting it, so it's like it's hard to know. Like, is that what he really wanted? I mean, I read the press notes too, and it's like, well, maybe it's his vision, but maybe not.
But I mean, for me, it's the Joker comparison. I think it's just that I don't agree with the worldview of either of these movies, and they're so cynical and so bleak, and you know, everyone seems to be miserable in these films, and it's like,
wait,
well,
you're saying that's not like life?
That just, I respond to humanism. It's not like things have to have happy endings, but that you have to have some sort of, like, you know.
Oh, do you?
Do we have another
hour?
Anything you're looking forward to this year?
No. Goodbye.
Gosh, I just need to change gears in my head here. I'll throw in, actually, just as I'm thinking, the one movie from 2019 that I put on in 10th slot was Waves, and I'm hoping that audiences catch up with it. You know, it's like because they obviously haven't seen it now. It seems like a crazy thing to champion a movie that, I mean, I've seen multiple times, but most people haven't and won't see once.
Portrait of a Lady on Fire gets its official opening next month.
In February, yes.
Even though it was here for a week and you know,
that's a film
critics
to look
got to see
to.
It.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess we're going to leave it there. Thank you all so much for coming in.
Thank you
again.
For having us. It's
always
a delight.
A treat.
It's absolutely delightful. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Where can people find you on the social media? Manola, I know you're tweeting and Instagramming up a storm.
At Manola Dargis. That's my
fending off 1917.
Manola Dark.
Just look for the 1917. Fur.
I guess a resolution for 2020 is to wade back out into the shark infested waters of Twitter. But it's like
all you have to do is just say to people no, and then and then mute them. That's my best way.
No, Manola's nah is always like the best response ever to any idiot on Twitter. I don't know why people just don't do that.
It's just like no.
Anyway, Ask DeBruges.
Ask DeBruges, right. And Robert?
At R.A. Abley.
Gotcha. All right. Now, there will be links to all that in the show notes. Real quick, just wanted to remind everybody to check out our friends on the internet. Bibbs and Whitney have a whole bunch of shows on their critically acclaimed network. And also check out The Schmoes Know, Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, Sewers of Paris, The Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review, please, and we will read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, like Spotify and Stitcher Radio and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean. Follow us on social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Follow his exciting career at Bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. And, we got a whole other year ahead, and we're going to make this thing work. So thanks for listening.
Are we?
Yeah, we'll do
it. Are you
best.
Sure?
Cats 2, that's what I'm looking forward to in 2020.
Until next time.
Goodbye.